You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. You probably know part of the Zodiac story. The guy killed five, wounded two, wrote letters in code, and drew tremendous press. There was a great movie about the case. But true crime veteran Michael Benson is taking a brand new look at that most interesting of cold cases, coming from the mindset that the Zodiac's combination of diverse killing styles, code making, and letter writing means more than one guy was involved. The Zodiac has teamwork written all over it, and so perhaps a Zodiac club. Many Zodiac experts assume that in later Zodiac letters, when he wrote the San Francisco Examiner letters claiming a prolific kill count, that the guy responsible for the murders of Betty Lou Jensen, David Faraday, Darlene Farren, Cecilia Shepherd, and Paul Stein, and maybe Cherry Joe Bates, was just bragging about the other 40 or so. Benson looks at it another way. All of them could have been the Zodiac, if the Zodiac was a psycho squad, not a lone nut. Each and every victim gets Benson's full attention. As the body count grows, there is ongoing analysis involving hard and circumstantial evidence, commonalities between the murders, geographic profiling, and pertinent connections to known Zodiac suspects. Many murders are examined. It was the era of serial murder, an epidemic especially bad in Northern California, where privacy, seclusion, dusty wilderness, and hitchhiking were prevalent. Some of these cases were found to not be the Zodiac at all, but perhaps a glimpse at the early work of a Ted Bundy, Ed Kemper, Golden State Killer Joseph DeAngelo, and other known killers, the next wave of psycho serial carnage. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Age of Zodiac, with my special guest, journalist and author, Michael Benson. Welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for this interview, Michael Benson.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure, Michael. Always looking forward to any new work of yours, and this is no exception. As you said before, just before this interview, finally we get to talk about Zodiac.
That's right. It's about time.
Let's start Go ahead.
No, well, I was going to say, I think we've both always been interested in Zodiac. I'm old enough to remember when the murders happened and when they published even in Rochester, New York, they published the codes from the letters in the morning newspaper. I remember sitting there trying to figure out the code. Of course, nobody ever has. I loved Robert Graysmith's book. I loved David Fincher's movie. But the subject came up more recently when I was planning a book called Killers Who Taunt, about serial killers who aren't content to just kill their victims, but they need to brag about it. They usually, in letters they write to the press or the police, so the terror becomes part of the package. Jack the Ripper is the prototype of that kind of killer. He gave himself the name Jack the Ripper in a letter he wrote. Since then, there's been the Black Dahlia Avenger, BTK, Unabomb, Son of Sam. And near the top of that list is Zodiac, who's credited for five kills, maybe six, but may be responsible for many, many more. And he was the most—he wrote the most taunting letters, different from the others. In all of those other cases I mentioned, the crimes would have been tied together even without the letters. Jack the Ripper's victims were all in the same neighborhood. He left uniquely messy crime scenes. Son of Sam crimes were all committed with the same gun. BTK loved knots, but the Zodiac's crimes would have remained separate cases if the letters and phone calls had not tied them together. He killed at night. He killed during the day. He killed rural. He killed urban. He killed with a knife. He killed with a variety of guns. So it makes more sense if he was a they, and the letters were written to create an all-encompassing umbrella, and the goal was to commit perfect murders. So we go back before the first known Zodiac murders in Vallejo, all the way back to the early 60s in Southern California, where crimes like this were starting to happen. There's one which I didn't put in the book, but I'll mention here. April 1962, a cab driver named Ray Davis was shot in an upscale section of Oceanside, California, with 22 Super X long ammunition, and he called the cops. He threatened bus drivers. He acted clever, but didn't strike again that anybody knew about. My book starts a year later, in June of 1963, and it's Senior Ditch Day. I don't know if you had Senior Ditch Day where you went to school, but
no.
Somewhere before, a few days before graduation, when finals are over, seniors get amongst themselves, and on one day they just don't come to school. They ditch class en masse, and what are they going to do about it? So then our two kids, Linda and Robert, Linda Edwards and Robert Domingos, went to the beach in Santa Barbara County, and they found a private spot, and they were shot with 22 Super X long rifle ammunition, and the killer created a little scene. He dragged their bodies into a nearby lean-to where a beach bum lived, and he cut Linda's panties and opened them and then placed her body on top of Robert's. Now, like 7 months later, also on a beach in Southern California, Ocean Beach in San Diego, another couple, Johnny Ray and Joyce Swindle, newlyweds, are taking a stroll along the beach, and they're shot with a Remington 22 rifle. First shots come from afar, sniper-like, and then the killer finishes the job up close. Ray was a Navy man, radio man, first class, and that's why he was stationed in San Diego. And then in the summer of 1965, this is really a very modern crime for 1965, in the most horrible way. Diane Garish, sometimes known as the Black Sapphire Murder, because she wore a black sapphire ring, which was missing. And she could have a book to herself. She was killed August 29, 1965, found nude and strangled with her own bronze stockings just outside the Presidio Army Post in San Francisco. She'd been dancing with soldiers at a club there. And she was last seen as the Fort Scott Presidio Enlisted Men's Club in Presidio Hill, and the killer took the ring and took off. And the one after that is the one I think a lot of Zodiac fans know about. I'll use the word fan, but you know what I mean.
Right.
We don't like the Zodiac. We're just fascinated by him or it. But this is Cherry Jo Bates, and she's killed the day before Halloween in 1966, found in a driveway on the campus of Riverside City College. Her car is disabled while she's in the school library. So when she comes out to go home, car won't start. Man offers to help her, and next thing we know, she's dead at the end of a driveway, stabbed brutally. And this is the thing that clinches it as a Zodiac crime, is that the killer writes a letter, or someone writes a letter, certainly, to the newspaper, and takes credit. So it's called the confession, but it's not a confession at all. It's a taunt. And in the letter, which is typed in all capital letters, there's common phraseology with later Zodiac letters. Uses the phrase squirmed and twitched. And twitched is missing its second T. Now, there's a later Zodiac letter that uses the phrase squirmed and twitched, and twitched is missing the second T in that word. So I thought it's almost like a signature. So we're pretty sure Cherry Jo has something to do with the known Zodiac crimes. But the first universally accepted Zodiac murders are David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen, who were obviously teenagers, and they lived in Vallejo, went to different schools, and were out on their first real date. And they were killed December 20th, 1968, was the first evening of Christmas vacation. And about 11:20 p.m., they were parked just off Lake Herman Road, which is a desolate road, connects Vallejo with Benicia. Two, three cars an hour go down it, no streetlights, can't see your hand in front of your face. And they're found with David lying on his back directly beside the front passenger side of the door. The door's open. All other doors are closed and locked. And cops knew it was a fresh scene because it's freezing outside. It's 28 degrees outside, and the engine is still warm. Betty Lou is dead at the scene. She's 28 feet from the car in the direction of the road, shot 5 times in the back as she fled. And David's DOA at Vallejo General Hospital shot point blank in the head. Now, there's a bullet hole in the back window of the Rambler, perhaps an indication that the victims were forced off the road. The common thinking is that they were parked to make out. But if you look at the photos, they're only 2 or 3 feet off of the road. And it's on a curve, so every time a car goes by, the inside of their car lights up. So it's not the best place to park. Now, there's 9 empty .22 caliber shell casings are found, 8 of them near the car. One's found inside the car. The killer put his gun into the car to shoot David. And the ammunition was .22 Super X long, same as with the cab driver in Oceanside and with Linda and Robert in the beach near Gaviota in 1963. Now, the murder weapon here was most likely a J.C. Higgins Model 80 .22 automatic pistol. Now, the kids had no dangerous enemies. But witnesses said that there had been an incident sometime in the recent past in which David Faraday had spotted a guy selling marijuana at the International House of Pancakes, IHOP, on Tennessee Street in Vallejo. Now, David's an Eagle Scout, and he threatened to turn the guy in, and the pot dealer in response threatened David. We don't know who the drug dealer was. But that IHOP becomes an epicenter of Zodiac activity in 1968 and 69, comes up again and again, which brings us to the following 4th of July and probably the most famous Zodiac's murders. This is the one that has Hurdy-Gurdy Man playing in the background in the movie. I'm sure, if you've seen the movie, you can never forget that.
Yeah.
David Fincher is a genius. But anyway... From a true crime point of view, no victim in this case is more interesting than one Darlene Farron.
Mm-hmm.
She's 22 years old, but her life has been a soap opera. She has a baby, and she's already trying the patience of a second husband. And unlike the kids on Lake Herman Road, Darlene has enemies. Plus, and I swear, I can't believe nobody's noticed this, Darlene bore a strong resemblance to Betty Lou. Now, if you knew them, you may not confuse the two because they gave off a very different aura. But
right.
Going by in a car, you could confuse the two. Little scrunch faces. Cute, but not necessarily glamorously pretty. But it's enough of a resemblance, for me anyway, to at least consider the possibility that Betty Lou's murder was a case of mistaken identity. Now, with Darlene on the 4th of July evening is Michael Mageau, who's 19, and he survives the attack, which is one of the reasons it's a blessing and a curse, because he tells us everything we know about what happened, but not really in the sturdiest and most trustworthy way. For example, they're parked in a brown Corvair, and when they first asked the wounded Mike Mageau what kind of car the killer drove, he said it was a brown Corvair. He said, well, no, that's the kind you're in. He said, well, maybe it was a Mustang. Either he knows more than he's saying or less than he's saying, but what he says keeps changing, and he's still changing his story to this day. And 9mm shells are found at the scene. So it's a different gun. It's a Luger. Mageau recalled that parking at that spot, which was Blue Rock Springs Golf Course parking lot, was Darlene's idea. My guess is that everything was Darlene's idea. It was a place where young people didn't just make out, but they hung out. And you could buy a nickel bag of pot. You could drink beer to socialize. And Darlene had been there many times. They parked at approximately 11:35 p.m. and for a couple of minutes sat quietly. But their solitude was interrupted by a car driving northeast on Springs Road. The car pulled into the parking lot up to a spot 7 feet from the rear of Darlene's car and turned off its lights. Mijot asked what was up, and Darlene said, "Oh, never mind." So he didn't. And the car sat there for about a minute and then left. And they breathed a common sigh of relief, alone again. But in a few minutes, the car came back and once again parked behind Darlene's car, now about 10 feet away. This time, the headlights stayed on, and the driver got out and shined a bright flashlight into the car. They couldn't make out his features. No words were exchanged, but the gunman opened fire and shot through Michael's open passenger side window. He left. Michael gave out a little scream, and the killer came back to the car, shot them both again. She's dead. He's wounded. He's been shot in through the tongue. He's having trouble speaking. Darlene dies soon after getting to the hospital, and he survives. And there are weirdnesses about this crime that have nothing to do with the killer. Mijot is wearing 3 pairs of trousers, 1 T-shirt, 3 sweaters, and 1 long-sleeved button shirt, and it's a hot, steamy 4th of July night. So this is extremely odd. You can imagine the people in the emergency room trying to undress him so they can get a look at his wounds, and the clothes just keep coming. He would later claim that he wore the extra clothes even on the steamy night because he was insecure about his skinniness. Well, trouble with that is he's 6 foot 170, which is about normal weight for a teenager. And he seemed confused and unreliable. So there are indications that maybe Darlene and Michael are in the parking lot at the golf course at night for reasons other than to get to know each other better. It is a spot known to buy nickel bags. And Darlene's husband was perhaps being euphemistic when he told police he sent Darlene to buy fireworks, even though it was the middle of the night after the 4th of July and an unlikely time to set off fireworks. Darlene only had 13 cents on her at the time of her death. Mijot said the car came, left, and came back, which could be the way it went if you paid the guy and then he came back to give you the drugs, only something obviously went very bad. Then there are weirdnesses that have everything to do with the Zodiac. About a half hour after the crime scene was discovered, the Vallejo police switchboard operator received a phone call from a man in a slow monotone, slow but forceful. "I want to report a double murder. If you will go 1 mile east on Columbus Parkway to a public park, you will find the kids in a brown car. They were shot with a 9mm Luger. I also killed those kids last year. Goodbye." And the last 2 words were elongated for effect. And it worked because Nancy, who took the call, has been haunted by that sound for the rest of her life. You know, she spoke to the Zodiac. "Oh, my God, how will I ever sleep?"
Right.
Now, the call was traced to a payphone at a Vallejo service station, Joe's Union on Springs Road. And police went to the phone booth and found the receiver still hanging down and off the hook. There was no sign of anyone, any suspicious activity in the vicinity. And although the phone booth was only a 10-minute drive from the crime scene, 30 minutes go by before the call was made. So the killer did something in between the shooting and the phone call. Best bet is that our guy is a local Vallejo guy. And there were several early suspects. 2 most intriguing were a guy named George Waters, a Filipino bartender, a customer that Darlene wouldn't go out with, and once went to her home and threatened to rape her. And especially interesting because he's Filipino, and a later Zodiac letter talks about collecting slaves for the afterlife, which is apparently a Filipino thing. And then there was Darlene's first husband, who then their marriage had been tumultuous and violent. So he would have naturally have been the first suspect.
Right.
And then it's after that.
We're going to stop just for 1 second for these messages. Now, you talked about complicating the case with George Waters and another suspect. How do police proceed? Before we talk about August 1st, 1969 in the San Francisco Examiner and the San Francisco Chronicle and the Vallejo Times Herald each received a letter.
Yes. Yes. They each get a nearly identical letter. It's not transcribed perfectly, but it seems to be an attempt at three identical letters. And then each one gets a third of a cipher. The envelopes were overposted. And the ciphers, if decoded, the letter promised, would contain a clue as to the killer's identity. The letter also established authenticity by describing, not perfectly, the type of ammunition used, the precise number of shots fired, and the positions of the bodies. And it contained details that were not in the newspapers, but he got things a little wrong, which may not discredit him as the actual killer at all. It may just be an imperfect memory, which is the way people are. But again, it looked like a teamwork effort. The printing was sloppy and prone to slant, yet the cipher was printed with precision on a grid with rows that lined up perfectly vertically and horizontally. Had the same hand created both the letters and the ciphers? Doesn't look like it. Code from the first letter was broken during the first week in August by a history professor and his wife. And it started, "I like killing people because it is so much fun."
Yeah.
Which is the theme of psychopaths ever since. It went on to say that hunting people was the ultimate kick. It's better than sex. And that when he died, he would be reborn in paradise, and those he killed would be his slaves.
Right.
That was a clue to his identity. And nobody figured it out. And a week later, the Manson murders take place in Los Angeles, and this guy loses the front page of the newspapers. You know, our Zodiac Club is going to have to up the ante if they want to again become the center of attention. And, you know, that something comes several weeks later at Lake Berryessa.
Right. You talk about Brian Hartnell, 20-year-old, and Cecilia Ann Shepherd at Lake Berryessa, 70 miles north of San Francisco and 40 miles north of Vallejo. Tell us about this incredible incident at Lake Berryessa.
Oh, well, this is burned into the nightmare of America, I think. The victims are on a blanket in the sand, a little peninsula sticks out into Lake Berryessa, which is a large lake in Northern California. And because they're on a peninsula, really only one way to and from their location. So when a strange man approaches, they feel a little trapped right away. Cecilia sees him first, and the man hides poorly behind a tree. So, oh, it's a weirdo. And they're on high alert. But that alertness turns to fear when the man reemerges from behind the tree wearing a black hood over his head that falls to a crest on his chest. And neatly and precisely painted on the hood in white was the circling crosshairs symbol that became Zodiac's logo. And he's holding a dark automatic pistol in his hand, which is the scariest part of all. And the hooded man orders Brian to lie down on his stomach and tells Cecilia to tie his wrists. This is interesting because we go back to Robert and Linda on the beach. The same thing appeared to have happened. The killer asked the girl to tie up the guy for him, which is an unusual thing to do. And Brian is tied by Cecilia using pre-cut lengths of clothesline that he brought. He then produces a long, thin knife and stabs Brian 10 times in the back. He ties up Cecilia himself, although he seems very nervous while he's doing it. And again, Brian survives the attack, which is the reason we know these details.
Right.
If both had died, we none of this, they would just be dead people on a beach and we wouldn't know what happened. He stabs Cecilia 3 times in the back, and when she writhes herself over onto her back, he stabs her once in each breast, once in the crotch, and once in the abdomen, and then goes berserk and covers her with holes with the knife. I mean, I read on the internet recently somebody saying that the Zodiac showed no signs of misogyny. You know, I felt like screaming. Look at the autopsy report on Cecilia Shepherd, if you think that. Anyways, his work done, hooded man leaves, and Brian's estimations of time of course, are all over the place because of the trauma he's
sure.
undergone. But he says the attack took place, it took about 15 minutes. And then there's a long delay before the victims are found. They have to wait until somebody sees them from the water. And then there's another delay for an ambulance to get there. Once they get Cecilia to the hospital, there's a problem with her blood type, and where she passes away.
Yeah.
And the killer, on his way out, writes a message on the passenger side door of Brian's car, which is a little teeny car, Volkswagen Carmen Ghia. And he puts the circle and crosshairs logo, which is his signature, Vallejo, 12-20-68-74-69 by gun, September 27, 1969, 6:30 p.m. by knife. And he also leaves footprints, size 10.5, wing walker shoes, which are government-issue shoes usually worn by Air Force personnel, so they won't slip when they're walking on the wings of planes.
Right.
But they're available to anyone. You can go to an Army-Navy store and get them. Now, just had been the case in July, there's a phone call. About an hour and 10 minutes later, man calls the Napa police. I want to report a murder, no, a double murder. They are 2 miles north of park headquarters. They were in a white Volkswagen Ghia. And the dispatcher, who's Officer David Slate, asks, "From where are you calling, sir?" And the caller responds in a terrifying whisper, "I'm the one who did it." Now they call. They trace that call to a payphone at the Napa car wash, corner of Main and Clinton Streets in Napa, which is on the way back to Vallejo, if that's indeed where the killer lived. And the Zodiac's next attack couldn't be more different. It would take place in an urban setting and in front of witnesses. And that's, of course, Paul Stein.
Mm-hmm. Cab driver.
So it's the evening of October 11, 1969. Stein, he's a PhD candidate, got several jobs, one of which is driving a yellow cab in San Francisco in the graveyard shift. And he picks up a man at the corner of Mason and Geary Streets, and the man asks to be taken to Maple and Washington, which is in the ritzy Presidio Heights section of San Francisco. There's that word Presidio again, keeps coming up.
Mm-hmm.
When they arrive at the corner of Washington and Cherry Streets, about a block away from the intended destination, passenger pulls a gun, puts it to the cab driver's head, and pulls the trigger. Now, this is important. The immediate aftermath to this murder is observed by several teenaged witnesses from a window across the street. The killer circles around to the front passenger side door, opens it, pulls the cabbie down across the seat, and then does something over the body. And we now know he's cutting a piece of shirt away so that he can use bloody shirt pieces as certificates of authenticity in future letters. But they didn't
yes.
know. They could just tell he's doing something over the body. He then fussed over the side of the cab for a time with a white rag in his hand, which the witnesses interpreted as wiping away fingerprints on the cab's exterior. The
right.
killer took Stein's car keys and wallet, maybe his sunglasses, maybe his eyeglasses, but left other items there and walked away casually on foot. Now, when the first police officers arrived, they could see a complete fingerprint in blood on the side of the cab. So apparently the killer wasn't wiping fingerprints away, but what else could he have been doing? Witnesses were asked about the bloody print, and the best they could come up with was, well, maybe he left it there while he was wiping the cab clean. That makes no sense. In a future
yeah.
letter, the Zodiac claims that he was leaving false evidence, which explained what had been seen and then found better than anything the investigators or eyewitnesses had to say. Now, despite the odd manner in which the print was left and found, it was and is still being used to eliminate suspects. How many suspects? All of them. The print has no known match. There's one 9mm shell casing found on the floor of the cab in the front of the passenger side. The gun's similar, but not the same as the weapon used at Blue Rock Springs Park. And that was the last of the official Zodiac murders, but just the beginning of the letter-writing campaign. Now, Paul Stein's dead, and the killer still doesn't have a name. He's being called the Cipher Killer in the newspapers, but
right.
that's about to change.
You talk about October 15th, and the San Francisco Chronicle receives a letter from Zodiac, and it also contains a bloody piece of Paul Stein's shirt.
Yes.
Postmarks from San Francisco. What does he? What else does the Zodiac claim in that letter? Incredibly.
Well, he has become now a full-fledged terrorist. He says he's got a plan. He's going to attack a school bus. He's going to shoot out the front tire and then just pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out. And that's the start of Zodiac Mania. I mean, all of Northern California is now obsessed with this guy. The parents are terrified that their kids are going to be attacked on their way to school. Every school bus has a police escort. Soon thereafter, the situation is complicated because a man claiming to be the Zodiac earns his 15 minutes of fame by calling a TV talk show in San Francisco
right.
and chatting with the famous lawyer Melvin Belli. Dispatchers who'd received phone calls from the killer, and it's the lady in Vallejo and the man in Napa, along with David Hartnell, listened to the broadcast and say it's not the same guy. I mean, Hartnell had a long conversation with the Zodiac, and it wasn't the guy on the television show who wanted to be called Sam. The letters continued from the killer claiming an ever-increasing number of victims. And by the time the letters stopped, it was up to 37. He
wow.
threatened to build bombs and blow stuff up. He quoted Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, The Mikado. He referred to cops as blue meanies, which comes from the animated Beatles movie Yellow Submarine. The communications, however, stopped claiming particular crimes, saying it was up to authorities to figure out who he had and hadn't killed. One letter contained a 340-character cipher resembling the ones that had been solved, but this cipher, if that is indeed what it is, has never been solved. The letters give us a tantalizing glimpse to the writer's personality. He's obnoxious. He's socially immature, but he never once offers anything that forwards the investigation. From a detective's viewpoint, the letters have been a big, useless distraction. And any theory based on decoding Z's clues, I call him Z, is immediately suspect. Now, after
mm-hmm.
Paul Stein's murder, it wasn't long before the mentally ill of Northern California latched on to Zodiac's game. Anyone could play. Call in a bomb scare, say you're Zodiac. Kill a hitchhiker, they'll think Zodiac did it. Who did the Zodiac Club actually kill? Well, there are plenty of people to choose from because there was an explosion of psychopathic murders in Northern California at that point. Just killing for fun. It was the new game. And I go through them all in the book in pretty strong detail. But I'll go through them quickly here. Starts with Elaine Davis. She's petite and 17. Her family phone number had recently been changed because of obscene phone calls. Leona Roberts, 16. Her father was from Vallejo. Victim had been bound at the wrists and ankles. Cindy Lee Mellon, whose car was disabled. She was last seen talking to a guy volunteering to help and was never found. Still technically missing. Cosette Ellison, 15. She's found nude and partially buried. Patricia King, 21. 3 days after Cosette, she's returning to her car when her life is interrupted. Judith Ann Hakkari, 23 years old, 2 days after Patricia King. And the first in a series of victims to be a nurse. She vanished returning home from work at the Sutter Memorial Hospital in Sacramento. Antoinette Ansi, she's a waitress like Darlene Farron, left her home in South Vallejo on March 13, 1970, got in her mother's car and disappeared, and her nude body was found 8 days later off a remote country road. Now, in the midst of the many psycho killings, there is a crime that the Zodiac does take credit for in a letter, and that's the abduction of Kathleen Johns.
Right.
And that's a very strange story because it's another indication that even if, you know, one guy isn't responsible for all of these cases, he's paying attention, or they're paying attention. The Zodiac Club is reading the news and responding, and sometimes accordingly. Anyway, Kathleen Johns, a 22-year-old woman, She's 7 months pregnant, and she's brought into the police station in Patterson, California, on the early morning of March 23rd, 1970. She's in hysterics. She told police that she'd been abducted by a man, and she and her infant daughter had managed to escape. She was driving late at night near Patterson when a car came up behind her and began blinking its lights. She pulled over, and the other car pulled alongside her. A man leaned over and said that her rear wheel was loose. He looked reliable to her. There was nothing freaky about him. So they took a look at the wheel. The hubcap was off. There were only two lug nuts present. So he offers her a ride to the gas station. Reluctantly, she, carrying her child, gets into his car with him. And she asked him if he always went around helping people. And he reportedly replied that by the time he was through with people, they didn't need any help. Now his car looked lived in. There were pots and pans, clothes for an adult man, and clothes for a child, all scattered around. Now, she says the guy drove her around for 2 hours, mumbling strangely and ignoring her pleas to be let out. Finally, he stops at a stop sign. She jumps out, runs into a field, and hides. He tries looking for her, but a farmer stops in a truck, says, "Hey, what's going on here?" And the man who gave her the ride took off. So she gets a ride to the police station, and she's hysterical. Cop goes to look for her car and finds it right where she said it was, only it's been torched, destroyed.
Right.
And while she's being interviewed, she looks at the wall, and there's a wanted poster for the Zodiac with a composite drawing based on Paul Stein witnesses. And
wow.
She freaks out. "That's him!" she screams.
Yeah.
Now, it is uncertain if this incident had anything to do with any of the Zodiac people. But one thing is absolutely for certain. The actual writer of the Zodiac letters mentions Mrs. Johns. Yes, he picked them up. Yes, he rode them around. Yes, he torched her car. The Zodiac also sent both Mrs. Johns and columnist Paul Avery Halloween cards with dancing skeletons on them. And her card, which was sent to her house, that must be scary, was addressed to the lady in the station wagon. So it's around this time that the Zodiac's primary function becomes extortion. He says, "Do as I say, or bad things will happen." And his requests are stupid. He wants people to wear buttons that have his circle crosshairs logo on them. Or else, if you don't wear buttons, he's going to explode a bomb and kill a bunch of people. He sends authorities a map with radians and a compass drawn over Mount Diablo, supposedly clues to help find the bomb. But like the letters, no one ever figures out what the map means. But again, we learned something. We learned that the Zodiac knows what a radian is. And a radian, for those that don't know, is 57.3 degrees. And it's used by engineers. The writer of the Zodiac letters has some sort of background in engineering or navigation. And then there's an indication that the Zodiac had visited Lake Tahoe, Nevada, with the disappearance of another nurse named Donna Lass.
Right.
She
in this letter,
is 20. Yeah.
Sorry, the letter talk about the letter at April 20th. How many victims is he claiming to have killed so far? And also talk about the expression blue meanies and what that refers to.
Blue meanies is, I don't remember the number of kills he claims in that particular letter. Is it up to 12?
10. Or, 10.
Okay. But blue meanies is his reference to policemen. And it comes from the villains in the Beatles movie Yellow Submarine. It's a pop culture reference. You know, I think one of the things we do learn about the writer of the Zodiac letters is what he likes. You know, and he likes the Mikado a lot. He goes to the Mikado twice in two different letters,
mm-hmm.
quoting from that. In one case, quoting in particular the Groucho Marx version of the Mikado. Groucho played the Lord High Executioner in that operetta, which is an interesting coincidence because I wrote a book last year called The Lord High Executioner about a mobster. But that's what that means. And then he sends a postcard, which is got pine trees and references to Lake Tahoe and supposedly clues as to where to find the missing person there. And the missing person is Donna Lass, who's a 25-year-old nurse, and another nurse, and she worked at the Sahara Tahoe Hotel. She was in the first aid room at the casino. And before that, she worked for 5 months at the Letterman Army Medical Center in the Presidio in San Francisco, near the Paul Stein murder and where Diane Garish was found horribly violated and murdered, missing her black sapphire ring back in 1965. Now, Donna was last seen at work on September 6, 1970, around 1:50 a.m. Her car was found near her apartment, but she was never seen again. And not long after she vanished, a male telephone caller called her workplace and her landlord and explained that she had to leave town abruptly due to an illness in the family. Now, a subsequent Zodiac letter seems to take credit for the disappearance. Plenty of other crimes that he didn't take credit. The epidemic of evil continues. And it's just, you know, it goes on and on. There's Nancy Benelak, Betty Clower, Carol Hilburn, all in Sacramento. And these are all within driving distance of Vallejo, if our boy still lives there. Benelak is stabbed to death only two blocks from the spot where nurse Judith Hakkari was abducted. Linda Keynes is a student at Pacific Union College. That's the same college attended by the Lake Berryessa victims, Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd. Susan Lynch, 22 years old. She's found partially buried in a dry creek bed, a hitchhiker, connected geographically to the Hakkari, Hilburn, and Benelak murders. And the killings continue through 1973. Gail McLaughlin, again in Sacramento, Rosa Vasquez in San Francisco, who once worked in a hospital in the Presidio, the same one where Donna Lass worked. Angela Thomas, whose dad had been stationed for years in the Presidio. Nancy Gidley, Nancy Fusey. And to round out a really rotten 1973, two 13-year-old girls in Sacramento, Valerie Lane and Doris Derryberry, were executed with a shotgun. Now, the killings extended through the first half of the decade in Santa Rosa and in other places. Girls hitchhiking, either alone or in pairs, were disappearing and being found in dry creek beds. And that's it. There are 37 murders at least, which I think is the highest number Zodiac ever claimed. And too many for one guy, too many different looks, too many different styles for it to be one fellow. So not only do we look at top suspects, we look at the chances that top suspects might know each other. And
let's use this as an opportunity. Sorry, Michael, let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. In my wife Lisa's FabFitFun fall box, Lisa was especially anxious to try Glossmetrics hair removal device and the blue light blockers from Nektar. Really, Lisa really liked them, uses them for reading online, much easier on her eyes. Lisa loves having FabFitFun boxes delivered, no need to leave home to shop. The fall box can be customized in 180,000 different ways. Lisa has received FabFitFun boxes for almost 3 years now and is still very excited to get each new box. The fall box, 8 to 10 full-size products, and customizable. Individually, the products would retail for over $500, but with coupon code, $39. Lisa recommends FabFitFun to everyone she encounters at work or out socially, because of the incredible value of these unique, amazing items. It's time to customize your box for the fall season. Sign up today to receive your first box and join a community of over 1 million women who are already obsessed. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at FabFitFun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at FabFitFun.com. Before I interrupted you, Michael, we were talking about the carnage that continued, but also that there was an interesting January development. January 29th, 1974, the interrogation of Arthur Lee Allen. And anybody who's seen the movie Zodiac obviously is familiar with the name. Tell us a little bit about this interrogation of Arthur Lee Allen for us.
Well, that interrogation is actually the second time that the police spoke to him. He is my suspect number one. I think he's just about everybody's suspect number one. There are dogmatic people on the internet who say that there are no suspects because the fingerprint on Paul Stein's cab has never been matched. But I'll get to that in a second. Arthur Lee Allen's been eliminated technically because of the bloody fingerprint. And the same is true of all other suspects. So officially there are no suspects. But let me talk about the print first, because it's the key. The question is, how could a killer who profiles out as possibly military, possible journey through the mental health system, possibly incarcerated, not have his fingerprints on file anywhere? And
really?
One appealing conspiracy theory, and I see this all the time, and people love this kind of stuff, is that the Zodiac was a U.S. government mind control experiment gone wrong. That in an attempt to create super soldiers for the war in Vietnam, they had produced a few rejects who washed out, and some were released back into society. Guys like that might have had their fingerprints erased from the system to prevent exposure. Now, there's no evidence there are evidence that those programs existed. No evidence really connecting those programs with the Zodiac crimes. But the Zodiac Club, I guess, might have been government issued, just like the killer's Wing Walker shoes. But I have another theory. At the Paul Stein scene, we have a guy who plans to take away part of the victim's bloody shirt so he can include pieces and letters to prove that he's really the guy. So he uses evidence. He's a guy who uses evidence, in that case, to terrify, but he could also use evidence to deceive. Say someone in the Bay Area had disappeared, a guy who'd never been fingerprinted and who was never going to be fingerprinted. And his finger, or his hand, wrapped up in a white cloth that the witnesses saw, was in the killer's pocket. When the teenagers saw the man fussing over the side of the cab with the white rag, in theory wiping prints away, perhaps he was actually dipping the finger in Paul Stein's blood and then using it to make a clear print in blood on the cab. Now, no one can ever be arrested for Paul Stein's murder because that fingerprint will never produce a match. It is the perfect murder.
Yes.
That's my theory. Now, back to Arthur Lee Allen. There are all sorts of reasons to make him suspect number one. For one thing, he lived right around the corner from the IHOP, and police records show that he was a suspect from very early on. Darlene Farron worked at that IHOP from 1966 to 67. David Faraday threatened a drug dealer in that IHOP, and Arthur Lee Allen lives about 100 yards from that IHOP. On October 6, 1969, as part of the Lake Berryessa investigation, police talked to him for the first time. And Sergeant Lynch of the Vallejo Police Department shows up and he asks Allen where he was at the time of the Lake Berryessa murders. And Lee says he went ski diving at Salt Point Ranch, stayed overnight, and returned to Vallejo on September 27th. He was unable to recall whether or not his parents were home that day. Now, I've read, I think, every Vallejo police report involving Zodiac, and most of the time, they mention the reason why a suspect was warranted scrutiny. There was a phone tip, observation of unusual behavior, an overheard comment, something. But this one has no indication of why Allen is being interviewed. So we don't know. He did somebody dropped a dime on Arthur Lee Allen right after the Lake Berryessa crimes, but we don't know what. He's later interviewed, and this was what you were asking about, later interviewed by Detectives Toshi and Armstrong of the San Francisco Police Department. It's a surprise visit at his workplace, and he's wearing a Zodiac brand watch with the circle and crosshairs on the face, which was the logo for the brand. So there's the circle and crosshairs, the word Zodiac, with each other on his wrist. During the interview, he mentions the most dangerous game, which is mentioned in the very first cipher.
Right.
And he said he'd been a suspect in the Lake Berryessa murders because someone saw him with bloody knives in his car. But it was okay because he'd just been killing chickens. Now, a couple of search warrants were eventually taken out, executed, but they failed to find any souvenirs from any murders. You know, they didn't find the black sapphire ring. Didn't find Paul Stein's glasses. Although the second raid did produce items that indicated that Arthur Allen was into bomb making, as was the author of the Zodiac letters. His trailer was in Santa Rosa, where he lived during the Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders, which I haven't spoken about yet, but there were a separate set of killings in Santa Rosa, girls hitchhiking. And his trailer was filled with porno and dead squirrels. You know, I would like to know just how many trailers are out there filled with porno and dead squirrels. I hope it was just one. Here's Dan. I think this is the most fascinating aspect of this case. Allen possessed an odd and perhaps unique skill. He was a star diver as a teenager and in his early 20s. He was a junior college All-American diver, did fancy dives off the diving board. And he could do something no other diver could do. He could do his fancy dives spinning right or spinning left. And he did them equally well both ways. All other divers have to pick one direction or the other. You're either right-handed or you're left-handed. So that's a tremendous level of ambidexterity.
Sure.
And that comes to mind when police tried to get writing samples out of him. Right in cursive, right and left, printing right, left, right, left. Allen claims he can't print right-handed because he'd been trained to print lefty in school and felt anxiety when trying to print with his right hand. The pen falls out of his hand when he tries to write. So the writing test that determines he didn't write the Zodiac letters is woefully incomplete.
Yeah.
Now, his personality also makes him a suitable serial killer candidate as well. Son of a Navy commander, yet he had been a corpsman in the Navy but was drummed out. He was always angry at his mother. He took a job at the Atascadero State Hospital, a mental hospital, but was fired in 1962. He's a big man boy. Makes people uncomfortable with his socially immature behavior. And he's a child molester. Never had a relationship with an adult that we know of. According to family members, he had spelling eccentricities, as did the writer of the Zodiac letters. Here's an unlikely coincidence. Lee Allen used to write X-MASS to mean Christmas.
Right.
An extra S. And that's the way it's spelled in the Zodiac letters. He also, tells his sister-in-law that he got a letter from somebody he knew at the Atascadero State Mental Hospital, and the letter has codes written in it, and he keeps it in a gray box. His history shows a remarkable proximity to the killer activities. He's in the area when Sherry Jo Bates is killed in Riverside. He only missed one day of work down there, and it was the day after Bates' murder. He's in Vallejo for the first two Zodiac attacks. He ate at the IHOP where Darlene Farron waitressed. He says he planned to go to Lake Berryessa on the day of the murders there, but he changed his mind at the last second. And those bloody knives, those were just chickens. And he lived in Santa Rosa at the time of the Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders, but his fingerprint doesn't match, so he's not a suspect. Now, the Arthur Lee Allen legend was enhanced by the incriminating statements of Allen's so-called friend Don Cheney. Don Cheney also is on our list as suspect number two. Cheney is best known as Allen's friend who had nothing nice to say about Allen. Allen told him he would take the name Zodiac and he would write letters to chide police in disguised handwriting. Then he would take off lug nuts to disable a woman's car. He loved Blake Berryessa and had a crush on a waitress at the Vallejo IHOP. So if you believe everything Cheney says, Arthur Lee Allen has to be the Zodiac.
Right.
Now, Cheney also said that Allen loved the Agatha Christie book, The ABC Murders, which is about a killer who murders victims with the same first and last initial in towns that also start with that initial, which is strange for me because that plot repeated itself in real life in Rochester, New York, and was the subject of a book I wrote with private investigator Donald A. Tubman called Nightmare in Rochester. But Allen liked the book for a different reason. Didn't care about the initials. The Agatha Christie book describes a series of crimes committed by one man, one crime with a clear-cut motive, and the others arbitrary to confuse the issue.
Mm-hmm.
A strategy that would have been high on any Zodiac Club's to-do list. Cheney himself has an excellent background to be a Zodiac Club member. Spent 2 years in the Air Force. He went to college with Paul Avery, the columnist that the Zodiac took great delight in terrorizing. His printing was close to that seen in the Zodiac letters. He also did something that always gets an investigator's attention. He tried to explain away evidence that the authorities didn't know about.
Right.
Now, this happened in the Martha Moxley case. Michael Skakel was one of the suspects, but jumped to the head of the class when he said that if you find semen in the lawn outside her home, that's just because I climbed the tree and watched her through her bedroom window. Well,
Jesus.
Police hadn't found any semen in the lawn, hadn't looked in the lawn for semen, but they all of a sudden had a renewed interest in Michael Skakel. Well, here, Don Cheney says, and this is more recently, it's about in the 1990s, this is after DNA technology is known of. And he says, well, you know, Lee always had me lick his stamps and envelopes for him because he didn't like the taste of glue. He said it made him sick. So, you know, just in case you find my DNA on the envelope, it's only because I lick the envelopes for him. And he also said that Lee had him press his right thumb into a ball of wax so Allen had his thumbprint. Plus, Cheney was a mechanical engineer who knew what a radian was. He died in 2009. Those are the two top guys, but I have other members of the Zodiac Club I suspect as well.
You talk about somebody named Tucker, and we didn't mention that one of the predominant vehicle spotted, or the most popular vehicle spotted, was a brown Corvair. So tell us about this Tucker and what police ask him about regarding that Corvair.
Tucker. This
Tucker
is after
the Corvair
Michael
as well.
Majot says that a brown Corvair. That Lee borrowed the car. Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're asking about?
Well, they were asking that this Tucker had a brown Corvair, so they were asking, you know, the police knew about a Corvair, at least that was what witnesses had said, so they were asking this Corvair.
The only reason that's interesting is because they believed Michael Majot. And I think that maybe they were a little bit off the... I think it's more persuasive evidence that the killer was in a white Chevrolet. We didn't talk about it, but before Betty Lou and David are shot, a sports car is parked in that spot because the driver's trying to figure out he's driving his girlfriend's car, and he's trying to figure out what the buttons do and how to put the bright lights on and off and that kind of thing. And they're chased out of there by a guy in a white Chevy, and the white Chevy reappears. The brown Corvair, I think, was the police trying to follow up on a on a clue that had been left by Michael Mageau, who was very, very confused when he said that. He
right.
came off of that car being a brown Corvair almost immediately and said, well, maybe it was a Mustang, and he didn't really know. And the guy, and who could blame him? He's been shot in the face.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get to the white Chevy a little bit more because that comes with its own suspect. But we'll start with Philip Hughes, who was a convicted serial killer. He became a killer because he wanted to kill an ex-girlfriend, but that would have been too obvious of a suspect, so he instead killed girls who reminded him of his ex. Now, experts say that as many as 6 serial killers were working in Contra Costa County during the 1970s. Hughes was one of them. He once called a victim's dad and said, "Your daughter is dead. I know because I'm the one who killed her," which is almost word for word what the phone call said after Lake Berryessa.
Right.
He was convicted of 3 murders and spent the rest of his life in prison. Next is James Crabtree, also known as James Phillips. That's Darlene Farren's ne'er-do-well first husband. He's an Army veteran. He told people he'd been an undercover agent in the Army, but got in trouble and spent time in the stockade at the Presidio. So he could have MK Zodiac reject, perhaps. He had a tempestuous relationship with Darlene, came to Darlene's funeral, spoke to no one, and later, after he was arrested as a suspect in her murder, told cops he didn't know Darlene was dead.
Jeez.
Next on my list is William Grant. This one's very, very strange. Grant had a military background and received 7 months of training in military code work, and then was an instructor in cryptography. And according to a police report, he apparently placed 3 separate calls within 1.5 hours after Darlene Farren's death to each of the family members. These calls were made before media announcement of the murder and made certain references indicating the caller knew Darlene. I'm not sure how the police know that, but that's in the report. Now, Grant drove a white Chevy, resembled the car seen on Lake Herman Road, and after the Lake Herman murders, but before Blue Rock Springs, Darlene's babysitter saw a white Chevy parked outside Darlene's apartment. Darlene told the sitter she was afraid of a man in a white Chevy because she'd seen that man kill someone. Now, we also have a report that Grant, or a man pretending to be Grant, went to local libraries in and near Vallejo and borrowed a book on code writing and a vinyl album of the Mikado, 2 things that practically define the Zodiac.
Gotcha.
So there's a lot happening there. I forget the particular type of Chevrolet he drove, but it had a wraparound windshield. But the windshield came all the way around to the passenger side windows. And one of the things the babysitter said was that she didn't know what kind of car it was, but it was white and it had a tremendously huge windshield, which describes William Grant's car perfectly. Now, next on our list is Rick Marshall. He lived in Riverside in October 1966 at the time of the Cherry Joe Bates murder. At the time of Paul Stein's murder, he worked as a movie theater projectionist and lived in a San Francisco basement apartment on Scott Street within walking distance of the Stein crime scene. Then there's Richard Gajkowski, or known as Dick Gike, G-Y-K-E. And 2 key pieces of evidence make him a suspect. Nancy Slover, the Vallejo police dispatcher, and Officer Slate, the Napa police dispatcher, talked to the Zodiac minutes after the shootings, and they said Gajkowski's voice was closer than any other they'd heard to the one they spoke to in 1969. And 2, Gajkowski spent 3 years in a mental institution, 1971 to 74, and those were 3 years when the Zodiac stopped writing letters. He lived for a time in Albany, New York, in the same building with Darlene Farren's first husband. Same building. And lived 10 miles from Vallejo in 1968 and 69. Albany, New York is another strange, particularly strange cluster because it's on the other side of the country. But there is a cluster of Zodiac activity there that I'll get to. Some suspects, like Lawrence Kane, seem to have been jerry-rigged out of the so-called clues plucked subjectively from Zodiac's various writings. Others, Ross Sullivan comes to mind, better suspect for one crime, in this case, Cherry Joe Bates, than he is for the others. John Cottreau murdered Leslie Perlov and Janet Taylor in the Stanford area. Donald Bujak was an Army vet with mental problems, and he's on the list because he was released from prison 3 days before the Lake Berryessa attack. And the list goes on. But I have a special section of the book for the Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders, which are important for a couple of reasons. So 1972 and 73, the girls and young women are all hitchhiking near Santa Rosa, and the second of these victims was Kim Wendy Allen, 19-year-old student at Santa Rosa Junior College. She was one of two Santa Rosa Junior College women on the list of Santa Rosa hitchhiker murder victims. Now, Arthur Lee Allen, of course, lived in a trailer in Santa Rosa with the dead squirrels and the porno. And there was another guy, though, named Fred Minnelli. And Fred Minnelli was Kim Allen's teacher at Santa Rosa Junior College. He died on August 24th, 1976, in a head-on collision. And in his car, police found his artwork, which was disturbing stuff. He drew pictures of women in extreme and torturous bondage, BTK. And one of the drawings was labeled Kim Allen, died bound up. And another appeared to be of the artist in drag and was not labeled Fred. It was labeled Frida. So we'll put him, he gets to be on the list. And the last thing I want to talk about is the Albany connection, because it's one of those weird side Zodiac stories. And I'm not sure that this has anything to do with the Zodiac Club that seems to be working out of Vallejo, California, but it's interesting anyway, because it ties in with other things. People glomming onto the avatar for their own nefarious purposes. On November 21st, 1969, this is right during the time of Zodiac's activity and the Manson activity, two bodies are found in a Los Angeles alley, man and a woman. The woman is Doreen Gall. She's 19, and she comes from Albany, New York. She's found nude except for Indian beads. The man and the woman had been beaten to death, and their eyes were slashed with a knife. And they were each stabbed 50 to 60 times. Anger, overkill. They were members of the Church of Scientology, which was much smaller in 1969. It was routinely referred to as a hippie cult. It's somewhat more than that now. And one suspect in the murders was a member of a London anti-establishment group called The Process, whose members were known to worship Satan. Now, according to the Valley Times, The Process was an offshoot of the Church of Scientology. Two things. The Process also comes up in the Son of Sam investigation by Maury Terry. And the suspect in this case was probably Bruce Davis, who hung with Charles Manson and is in prison for life for two 1960 murders that he committed while pretty much acting under Manson's guidance. Now, in Doreen's room, and she's the 19-year-old victim, found naked with the beads, they go to her room, and they find a typed note signed the Zodiac. And the letter picks up additional significance in 1973 when another clearly spurious Zodiac letter is sent to the Albany Times Union, Doreen's hometown, and a code in that letter was deciphered to reference the Albany Medical Center, which is basically across the street from the home in which Doreen Gall grew up. So I have one Zodiac victim, and two suspects have Albany, New York connections. Darlene Farron and her first husband lived in Albany after they were married in 1966. And Jim worked for the Albany Times Union. Richard Gajkowski, we talked about before, whose name has been bandied about as a Zodiac suspect, also worked for an Albany paper, the Knickerbocker News. So that's it. The The Age of Zodiac.
You talked about in the beginning of the book, and we hadn't mentioned this, that you felt, or you talked about Anton LaVey, Church of Satan, and 1966, and its significance, talked about the age of the New Age of Satanism. As you do in the book, tell us a little bit about your ideas about that.
Well, that's something that happened to me a long time ago. When I was investigating the murders of my friends when I was a kid, George Ann Formicola and Kathy Bernhardt, who were murdered near the summer solstice in 1966. And I read that Anton LaVey, who was the head of the Church of Satan, and a friend of the guy who started Scientology, they each started their own religion, pretty much in competition with one another. So one I'll get people to worship science, and I'll get people to worship the devil. You know, $5 to the guy who recruits the most people into their cult, and I guess Scientology wins. But he wrote a book called The Satanic Bible, and it claimed that the age of God being in charge was over, and that the age of Satan being in charge was to begin. And that 1966 was year one of the age of Satan. So, you know, I don't think that Anton LaVey necessarily was a criminal in his own right, but he attracted weirdos to his cult. And I don't really want to call it a religion. And who could say what they would do? But since my girls were killed near the summer solstice, I said, well, gee, maybe there were other bad things that happened that year that would indicate that maybe there's something to this Age of Satan business. So I checked Halloween, 1966, and that's Sherry Jo Bates, believed by some to be the first Zodiac kill. August 1st was another black holiday. And that was the day that Charles Whitman climbed to the top of the tower in the University of Texas and shot a bunch of students sniper style, thus becoming the first school mass shooting in U.S. history, long before Columbine. So it really does seem like 1966 is an opening of a sort of Pandora's box of evil, from which the Age of Zodiac is one of the things that emerges. I mean, that summer's also Richard Speck, who kills 8 nurses in Chicago, and not far away from there, the strange murder of Valerie Percy, who was the senator's daughter, who is killed by someone who gets into the house using a glass cutter and, you know, kills her and gets away. So and that was a crime so startling that CBS was planning to show the movie Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's movie Psycho, for the first time on the network, and they canceled it. And I think to this day, CBS has never shown the movie Psycho. You can see it on TV now, but its network premiere, which was all built up and was going to be a big thing, canceled because of killing for fun was out of control during the summer of 1966 in a way that it just hadn't been in previous years.
You write about Arliss K. Perry, 19-year-old, stabbed in the back and neck with an ice pick still protruding from her head.
Yeah.
You said this was similar to the Black Sapphire murder that we mentioned in San Francisco.
Yes.
Tell us, there's some incredible details, and then why was this not considered a satanic ritual slaying?
Well, yeah, I first learned about Arliss Perry when reading a book called The Ultimate Evil. It's Maury Terry's book. And he claims that he was talking to David Berkowitz after Berkowitz's arrest in the Son of Sam cases. And Berkowitz made reference to Arliss Perry. And he found that there's this horrible crime in the church on the campus of Stanford University. She's been violated with a church candle, and There's another one found between her breasts, and it just looks like a black mass has taken place. Why it was not considered satanic is probably because authorities, as a rule, don't like to speculate. They don't like to ask questions they can't answer. They like small problems rather than big problems, and they avoid unnecessarily terrifying the community. So you could call that whatever you want. All you have to do is describe the crime scene. People are going to be terrified. The Night Watchman has since been, they finally made a DNA match with Arliss Perry and linked the murder to the Night Watchman at the church. But we don't know. We don't know the details if he was alone or if there was a black mass going on, because when they went to his house to arrest him, he committed suicide.
Yeah.
So that's always going to be a mystery, the Arliss Perry murder. It's a horrible deal. And, there were a couple others. Stanford was a dangerous place at that time. At least three co-eds were killed. But all three have been solved.
You talk about, when we started this program, this episode, he talked about the possibility of more than one Zodiac, more than one perpetrator.
Sure.
Tell us more about your theory about this club and how this unofficial club could operate and why.
Well, I think it is the answer to the question, how do you commit the perfect murder? If you are two men and you each want to kill someone you hate, you could switch murders, and therefore each will have an alibi for the murder for which he would be a suspect. That's the basis for the movie Strangers on a Train, another Hitchcock movie. And of course it goes wrong because the two men have to keep their word and their bargain with each other, or else it doesn't work. But if you are a group of people and you are connected to one another in some other way, you belong to an actual club, or you were all in the service together, or you were in a wing of a mental hospital together or something, and you wanted to kill for fun, I think what you could do is create a all-encompassing avatar, call it the Zodiac, and then you could go out, do your thing, a phrase that the Zodiac liked, and the Zodiac would then take credit for all of it. And since the Zodiac would be assumed to be one guy, no one would get caught. And obviously, if you're using fingers from people who never have or never will be fingerprinted to put down false evidence, it's close to the perfect murder. I don't know how.
You write about.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I even if the truth came out, I don't think, and then there were people in this group who were alive, still alive, and they'd be old by now. I don't think you could get a conviction, because what defense attorney wouldn't jump all over that fingerprint? You know, The fingerprint is in blood. It's in the victim's blood. It times itself. On a cab, the problem is that you have thousands of fingerprints, and there's no telling when each one was put there. But by doing it, by dipping the finger in the blood and then putting it on the cab, you have timed it. And the police absolutely help by saying, well, no one else touched the car. It must be the killer. But you had the witnesses, and the witnesses were what the guy didn't count on, saying we saw him with a white rag fussing over there. You don't fuss with a white rag and then leave a perfectly good fingerprint.
It's interesting, all of the varied descriptions of the Zodiac as well, just to lend credibility that there might have been one, more than one. It's really the separate descriptions of these potential perpetrators, isn't it?
Right. I think in an effort to sell it as one guy. They all wore eyeglasses.
I see.
But, yeah, they're different guys. I mean, you've got 6 foot, 200 pounds, 5'8", 150 pounds. Everybody seems to agree that the Zodiacs are dumpy dressers. Their clothes don't fit properly. They seem soft. You know, nobody ever describes somebody who's in really good shape, but they are dramatically different in size. Yeah, so it could all be a group of men all playing the same part.
You talk about the role of the media in this. You talk about the role of the media in this as well, because of course that's their business, is to fan the flames, and whether it's accurate or not, and occasionally or often. You talk about the Zodiac too in this book, about the phenomena in the Big Apple and the tabloids originally trying to link it to the Zodiac. Tell us a little bit about this attempt and who it ends up being. Again, similar, someone shooting into parked cars at kids and write taunting letters. Tell us about this comparison in New York City.
Well, yeah, there was an attempt by, I suspect, at least a couple of guys in the East New York section of Brooklyn, which is a very poor section. A lot of New York has made a comeback since those days, but East New York's really not one of those sections. And this guy, he did something that the original Zodiac forgot to do, which was involve astrology. For all the Zodiac business, there's never talk of Virgo and Sagittarius. They don't care. Zodiac's just the name of the guy, and that's it. But these guys in Brooklyn took it more seriously, and were going to kill 12 people all with different astrological signs. And one theory was that they were going to kill those people in places in New York so that the map would, if you connect the dots, it would be like the star pattern of one of the astrological signs. So the interesting thing here is there's no word for this phenomenon, but there's a really good eyewitness early on in these series of crimes. And again, in order to become a notorious Hall of Shame psycho killer, you have to pick victims of high quality. The richer and more beautiful your victims, the more play you will get in the press.
But sure,
this guy had a zip gun and was killing people who were inebriated at 3 a.m. and bums on park benches and things like that. But the original description results in a composite drawing, which is identical to a fellow named Colin Ferguson, who in 1993 became known for the mass murder known as the Long Island Railroad Massacre. He earned a little notoriety later because he defended himself in court. It was all a fiasco.
Yeah.
But when they finally catch the guy, he's a guy named Perdo Seda, who's tall, thin, and a light-skinned Puerto Rican man, as opposed to Ferguson, who's kind of a round black guy. So it's interesting. Never before. Sometimes the composite is so good that it's obviously the guy. Like Richard Speck. When they were looking for Richard Speck, they didn't know his name yet, but there was a drawing that looked just like Richard Speck in the newspaper. They were looking for Colin Ferguson, and he remained free for 3 more years and then eventually committed his own horrible crime to get him thrown in jail forever.
Yes.
But yeah, it was an attempt, the last attempt, we hope, to glom onto the Zodiac thing. And it worked because New York has competing tabloids, and they love that kind of thing. But the second that case was over, it was over.
You talk about your... Sorry. You talk about your favorite suspect in this as we wrap up this. Robert Lee Allen, or pardon me,
Arthur
Allen.
Arthur. He's called
Lee Allen.
I don't think anybody ever called him Arthur. I don't know why.
Yeah, Lee Allen. This is, you said that this was your best suspect. Before I let you go, tell us just a little bit more why you believe that Arthur Lee or Lee Allen was the perpetrator, Zodiac.
Well, if you remember when I was talking about the double initial killer, and I had a suspect who got upset with me because the guy's name was the alphabet killer and I should get it right. Arthur Lee Allen is the only suspect who always insisted on saying the Zodiac. People saw it, are you Zodiac? Are you Zodiac killer? And he said, I am not the Zodiac. And in the letters, it's always the Zodiac. He's not a Zodiac. He's the Zodiac. This is the Zodiac speaking, which, again, is very naval. This is the captain speaking, this way announcements are on ships.
Right.
And he does the world's worst job of seeming innocent. He can't stop toying with the blue meanies. He has to mention the most dangerous game in his interview with the two detectives in San Francisco. He wears that watch, and this is a couple of years have gone by. He's still wearing the Zodiac watch, and it's the best bet that the watch leads to the name of the killer, because it has the logo on the face of the watch. It's the only place where those two things are together.
Mm-hmm.
He fits the profile psychologically, you know, dominating mother, a smothering yet chilly relationship with parents in general. You know, when he cried for help, they bought him a boat. Maybe a hug would have been better. He was a great disappointment to his parents. He tried to have a naval career like his dad and didn't last because, you know, he liked children too much in the wrong way. And I think history demands that Arthur Lee Allen be the Zodiac. That's why efforts to clear him are suspicious. Not their intent, but just, you know, he can't be the Zodiac because this, this, and this. Well, let's take a look at those three things, because they might be the things that are wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Michael, for coming on and talking about your new book.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
The Age of Zodiac. It's been fascinating.
It's one of my favorite cases. I'm glad I had an opportunity, largely due to the pandemic, to put the time into writing a book about the case. And it's obviously nothing good about the pandemic, but it has given me some time to write.
Certainly, and you've been quite prolific. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about The Age of Zodiac. For those that might want to take a further look, do you have a website and a Facebook page for Amazon?
Well, you know what, I think we'll tweet me. It's get a pencil. It's at Michael 090301 07. No last name. At Michael 090301 07. And ask me anything. I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
have a great
Dan.
Night. Michael Benson.
You too.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.